From the Sky News Centre at 5, severe weather warnings have been issued for northeast England, including Yorkshire and County Durham. Heavy snow's already swept across the country, bringing disruption to roads, railways and airports. So far, the south and east of England are the worst affected areas, with 8 inches falling in Kent, Essex and Sussex. Around 100 people were trapped at a works party near Maidstone.
When it was time for our taxi to pick us up at midnight, we was told that they'd shuttled the road off so that we couldn't go home, basically, so we was left there.
Took a load of material that was there used to decorate the actual hall, and it was people were wrapping it around themselves, and the tablecloths were being whipped from tables left, right and centre, and people were wrapping themselves in that, and we were just trying to huddle up.
Three armed robbers who murdered a sub-postmaster have been jailed for life and will each serve a minimum of 34 years. Craig Hodson-Walker was shot during a raid at his parents' post office in Worcestershire in January. Craig's mum, Judith, says today's sentencing brings a small amount of comfort.
The fact that evil has been... good has beaten evil. The fact that they will be locked up, they will not have an easy life.
Two people, including a retired constable, have been arrested over allegations that police kept information hidden from the Stephen Lawrence inquiry. No one's ever been convicted of murdering the black teenager in South London nearly 17 years ago. World leaders are edging towards a climate change deal in Copenhagen, but a new draft agreement has allegedly dropped a deadline of 2010 for reaching a legally binding treaty. President Obama says the chance to agree a global deal hangs in the balance, and that an imperfect deal was better than nothing. Administrators for the book chain Borders say all of its outlets will cease trading next Tuesday. They've not been able to sell the business. Cricket. England trailed South Africa by 71 runs at the close of day 3 of the first test at Centurion. They're all out for 356 in their first innings, with the hosts ending the day on 9 for 1 in their second. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
It's morning at the Jones House.
Morning, love.
Oh, another day of meetings.
Meanwhile, in the kitchen... younger brother James and Clive the dog head down to get their breakfast.
Phew, something smells down here. There's a horrible smell of gas down here, Mum. Don't flip the switch!
Mrs. Jones calls the National Gas Emergency Service line on 0800 111 999.
Hello, yes, I can smell gas in my house.
Okay, if you can open up your doors and windows to allow some ventilation, please do not switch on or off any electrical appliances. We will have an engineer with you very shortly.
Well done, James. I didn't know about that switch thingy.
We make a good team, don't we, Clive?
Smell gas? Don't risk it. Call free on 0800 111 999.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and our guest this week to discuss some of the big stories this week in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Wiltshire-based crop circle maker and film producer Matthew Williams. Our regular old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too, as well as our reporter Marina Morris, who this week takes a close look at the difficult divorce of the Russian oligarchs now resident in the UK. That's Roman Abramovich and Boris Berezovsky. In the second hour from 6, Billy Quain will be here with his credit crunch beating What's On For Free This Weekend. If you can afford Worst Buses Monopoly bus fares to get there, that is. Also, after 6, we'll be talking to Matthew about crop circles and some of the secret military bases between Bath and Chippenham. Is it true that this is where the royal family would hide out in case of nuclear war? That's in the second hour. We'll be discussing this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our Friday Drive Time weather forecast from MetCheck.com. This weekend, average temperatures minus 3 degrees Celsius. Yes, that's in the daytime. A small amount of snow is possible on Saturday evening, but it should be dry and bright on Sunday. Next week, also averaging minus 3 Celsius in the daytime. A dry and sunny week, but with some pretty strong winds towards the end of the week. That was this week's weather forecast from MetCheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news now, and joining us live here in the studio this evening is Wiltshire-based crop circle maker and film producer Matthew Williams. Hi, Matthew, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Mr. Gosling.
And are you yourself from Wiltshire, or what?
No, I'm very much Welsh, and not exactly proud of it.
And what about crop circles? What got you into the crop circles? Were you, before you actually came to Wiltshire?
I was in Wales at the time, living, and I sort of got into UFO research, things like that. I became quite a well-known writer for magazines and talking about these things at lectures. Didn't really like Wales, found out a little bit about crop circles, went and researched those, found out that it was people making crop circles, decided to get involved making crop circles, and then realised the grass was a lot greener across the Severn Bridge.
OK. Tell us about the circle makers, then. What kind of people are they? Are they all completely different, or do they tend to be of a certain mould?
Yeah, they're all basically complete lunatics.
Really? Yeah. And yourself included?
But yes, it's definitely, the more time that goes on, the more lunatic I become.
So what does drive people to make these crop circles, then?
Well, a lot of them are artists, and they're interested in the reactions that the crop circles give people. I wanted to sort of get myself inside this community so that I could find out more about what the people were like, you know, because it's all very secret, it's an underground community. Eventually breached their sort of secret barriers by making a few circles and saying, well, look, you know, these were mine, what do you think, guys? And they said, oh, right, you're a circle maker now. Oh, you can have all our secrets. So that's the way you get involved, is you have to make a circle to get inside that. And then I started documenting who these people were, trying to get the information out there. Eventually, I got arrested for making crop circles in 2000.
Yeah, I think it's true to say that you were actually the first person, or maybe, I don't know if it's the only, but certainly the first person in Britain to be arrested for making a crop circle.
Yeah, I think I might be the only person, actually, to ever be arrested for making a crop circle. And the problem was I was telling people too much about how it's done. And the researchers who want to say that it's aliens are doing this, they don't like that. So they arranged for information to be passed on to the police, which then got a knock on the door, 16 police officers to come and see Mr. Bad boy crop circle maker, and then the rest is history.
Okay, now Martin Summers is here too. He's our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, by way of introduction this week, we've heard that Britain is in more debt than it's ever been, nearly £500 billion. Does that matter? Would you like to give us your take on that little question?
Well, of course it matters. It'd be absurd to pretend that it didn't. Whether it matters as much as some people are pretending is another matter. Countries have always been in debt. We've had a national debt since the Napoleonic Wars, and we've never paid it off yet. So I think there's an element of scaremongering involved in this as well.
OK, so if you were Chancellor, would you be really biting your nails now with all this debt?
I'll be biting my nails because the situation is dramatic, but it's the public debt is a problem, but it's not the problem. The problem is the insolvency of the private banking system, which has brought about the public debt that we're talking about. So talking about the public debt as the problem is missing the point. The banks have collapsed, and we've stepped in to bail out the banks. That's why we owe loads of money. Perhaps we shouldn't have stepped in to bail out the banks, but that's another question.
Have the banks collapsed because they've lent so much money to the Chancellor and to the public?
No, the banks have collapsed because of the creation of a shadow banking market since the big bang in the city in the 80s and the liberalisation regime of Reagan and Thatcher. They've been allowed to go away and basically do stuff that previously they were not allowed to do for good reason. They were banned from doing it because it creates bubbles and then causes crashes and depressions. And that's why the rules were there in the first place, which were taken down, which allowed them to do this, which has got us into the mess. The governments all over the world have stepped in to bail out the banks, and that's why the governments now find they haven't got money for schools, hospitals, etc. But of course, the answer to this is not to cut money on schools and hospitals. It's to do something about the banking system.
OK, now let's come and have a look at some of this week's news stories. We'll start with my husband would kill to defend our family. So why has Munir Hussein been jailed for protecting his? This is a pretty grisly story, and it's to do with knife-wielding and masked intruders who tied up this man's family and threatened to kill him. And as a result, He then chased one of the attackers afterwards and assaulted him. Now, it's ended up with the people who were originally who had their houses invaded having a prison sentence and actually no sentence for the one guy who the police have actually caught for this. Do you want to start with this, Martin? What are your thoughts on the idea that that you know you should really just simply phone the police and leave it to them rather than actually taking any action yourself?
Well, I mean, frankly, if you are threatened by somebody who's potentially violent, you're well advised not to try and fight with them. It's only property. If they're trying to steal your property, then I would say, well, let them steal your property. It's not worth your life. Do you remember the lady who tried to fight to get her handbag back and was run over? I mean, it's not worth being run over to get your handbag back. And, of course, what happens is people have a natural reaction of wanting to fight back. But often it's not wise because, you know, your life's more precious to you than your stuff.
What about actually following them, though? Because you may not... I mean, it seems to me what the judge here has been so annoyed about is that he then decided to actually assault the guy rather than just chase him and inform on where he was going, etc., to the police.
Well, listen, I don't want to make a comment about this...
Because the police weren't on the scene, were they?
This particular case is obviously... there will be particular questions about this particular case. But if you remember the case a few years ago when the elderly farmer shot dead the 16-year-old burglar with a shotgun, and a lot of people... He got a lot of sympathy, but what people failed to realise is that was not a legally held shotgun, and it wasn't even a normal shotgun for shooting birds. He bought it in a catalogue over the internet, and it was a pump-action shotgun used by the US Marines. And his first reaction when he's got a 16-year-old boy in his house is to shoot him dead. Now, I understand his paranoia and his fear, but he shouldn't have a gun like that. And the 16-year-old was a tea leaf. He was a thief.
Well, there's a big difference.
He was a burglar, but he'd never been involved in any violence, but the boy's dead. And you can't just have people killed for being burglars. It's not reasonable.
Well, there is a big difference in this case because, of course, they weren't just burglars. They were robbers, these people. They were burgling with violence as well.
Well,
what I would say
if I was sitting on the jury here is there's lots of mitigating circumstances. You shouldn't chase after people and assault them. You should just phone the police. But if you have done that after that kind of provocation, then there ought to be some kind of recognition that that is, you know, people have been severely provoked here. But I wouldn't like to comment too much on an individual case because it really is up to the, you know, that's why we have courts and juries and so on. It's all very well for me to pontificate. The right amount of force to be used is a careful judgment that needs to be made in each case, isn't it?
This is a bit of a moral dilemma, Matthew, isn't it? Don't you think? What are your thoughts on this story?
Wasn't the guy who shot the 16-year-old with a shotgun actually shot him in the back? Am I right in that?
Right.
I mean, that's the problem. I think the law is quite clear on this, and everybody knows if somebody comes into your house and you're defending yourself inside your house, you have justification, provided these people had weapons on them or they were acting in enough of a threatening manner, you're fine. I mean, I actually know somebody who killed somebody in Bristol with a knife because he opened his door and three gentlemen sort of forced their way in. He happened to have a knife in his hand because he'd walked from the kitchen to the front door, and he actually put the knife into the person. And the police said, fine, you know, not a problem, because they were forcing entry to your house. You acted in a very quick manner, and, you know, they didn't even charge him. They said, this guy was a nasty guy, well done, you're a credit to the community. And that was something that happened in Bristol.
So if it had happened the other side of the door, the front door, then this would have been a different matter. Crikey.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, that's the way the law stands. OK, let's have a look at the next story then. Ahmadinejad is blaming capitalism for climate change. Now, this is the story we have not been able to get away from the last couple of weeks, even if we wanted to. That's the Copenhagen summit, and it's all coming to a climax, apparently, at the moment and over the weekend. But the Iranian president is basically saying that the problem is not that we are over-consuming, it's that we have a capitalist system which is driving a profit-making approach to world resources, and he says that must be avoided. He's actually expressing Tehran's support for the Kyoto Protocol. The Iranian president has said world leaders should spend money on cutting greenhouse gas emissions instead of allocating massive military budgets to waging wars. Well, he's obviously taking this opportunity to have a pop at the West, who are always criticising his regime, and that story comes from Press TV. What are your thoughts about the Iranian president's take on the climate talks, Martin?
Well, I mean, we've got that obviously there's doubts been raised in the last few weeks about whether climate change is caused by human beings and all the rest of it. I mean, as I've said on previous weeks, whether it is or it isn't caused by human beings, we've got to do something to try and stop the massive misuse of the world's resources, which is what Ahmadinejad is drawing attention to here. I mean, we've got a situation where a small proportion of the world's population, mostly living in Western countries, and not even most people in those countries, are consuming virtually all the world's resources, and it's causing all kinds of tensions and violence. And
but don't you think
we've got to have a fairer way of distributing?
But don't you think he's sort of abusing his position here to play a bit of party politics?
I think he's doing what politicians do. He's putting his case as he sees it, and he's using. I mean, what he's pointing out is, for example, that Britain, for example, is going to have a nuclear power program supposedly to prevent global warming. We've discussed that in previous weeks. And he's saying, well, if you're allowed to have a nuclear power program to prevent global warming, why the hell aren't we? And that is irrefutable.
Matthew?
I think you're coming on to this with a nuclear power program in a up and coming news piece, but we'll come back to that, I suppose. I think that there isn't any global warming, to be honest. I mean, I've researched this myself. I don't, you know, there isn't in the sense that we're causing it. I mean, of course, the temperatures are rising, but it's not through CO2, because if you look at how much CO2 we put out, it's infinitesimal compared to plants and the sea. And if that's the case, then what are you going to do?
So all these scientists are all sort of being bribed and to talk nonsense, are they?
No. I think that the scientists have actually been saying that the amount that people put out, if you total the absolute amount of greenhouse gases that people put out, it is nothing compared to those that are put out in nature.
So I know the figures.
You're going to have to ban plants and the sea.
Well, the figures I've heard are around about 5% of CO2 is generated by human activity,
yes.
The rest by plants.
So what's all this? It's a conspiracy to actually control people. And I mean, I've been reading a lot on the internet, on underground sites, saying that it's all to bring in a police force that are going to go around and look at your house and see whether or not they can tax you and even evict you from your house based on whether or not you keep the fire.
Well, that sounds like scaremongering tactics. Surely
absolutely.
That's not what's being discussed at Copenhagen, is it?
But it's part of it, because the United Nations are looking at these police forces, which are in America. They've got them right now. There are policemen going around looking at your house and fining you and threatening to evict you from your house if you are, in their opinion, doing something which is causing too much greenhouse gas.
But isn't it actually something needs to be done, surely? I mean, you're saying that you don't believe that global warming is happening. I can tell you,
in the
last 20, 30 years, well, that's what you said at the very start.
Yes, global warming is happening, but it's not through the CO2 that we are releasing. It's through a natural change which happens. You know, it's been marked over the centuries that you get these warming periods. Climate goes colder for a period, and we're in one of those periods where we're going a little bit warmer at the moment, and then it'll go over the top and it'll go down. And they aren't even bringing into things like the global dimming, which affects things as well. It's got to be the gases we're producing, and it's got nothing to do with the way the sun's output.
Just tell us about what is global dimming?
Global dimming is the sort of light from the sun actually, you know, going down in level. So it's actually affecting, and it in different ranges as well, sort of changing in different frequency, so it affects how it can actually transmit through the atmosphere. And you know, we may be having a period of global dimming, you know, which is something that people don't take into consideration. It's all about CO2. It's all about the politics and the money that can be generated from a myth. And I know all about myths. I know how myths work very well because of the crop circles, you know. Once people get on this bandwagon, it's very hard to shake.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is that there's a massive amount of rainforests and ordinary forests that have been cut down over the last 30, 40 years. I'm sure that has, since the Second World War anyway, I'm sure that lack of CO2 that was being generated by all that green vegetation must have also contributed to this. Do you want to have a final word on this, Martin?
Well, I mean, I'm agnostic about global warming. I rely on scientists, and scientific opinion clearly is to some extent split. I think we've got to actually share the world's resources in a fairer way, and whether that's and we don't want that done by a police state, but it's got to be done through some kind of agreement. I don't believe in this cap and trade stuff, which is what the West is pushing at Copenhagen, because what that means is that we're allowed to carry on polluting as long as we pay off developing countries, and the developing countries are just saying you're not paying us enough. So there may not be an agreement by this time tomorrow, precisely because of that kind of attitude.
But
this cap and trade is just another hedge fund game. Yeah, these guys that buy and sell bits of paper want to buy and sell bits of paper with carbon credits on them, and we don't want that. If we're going to do something about changing the way we run the economy, we're going to have to start planning to produce more stuff with less resource input, and that's got to be done through a plan, not through some market game.
One of the other things Ahmadinejad is saying is he's calling on the major powers, particularly the US, to dedicate a part of their military budgets for fighting pollution. He's also saying that he's slamming Washington for thwarting Tehran's efforts to combat climate change by opposing its nuclear program.
Well, he's making his political point, as we said earlier.
But isn't there actually something to this? Because he's actually saying that one of the reasons that they're interested in having nuclear power in Iran is because this is going to do a massive amount to reduce fossil fuel emissions. Because obviously, you know, sitting on so much oil, the Iranians use most of their power is generated by fossil fuels and non-renewable energy.
Actually, they don't have the refinery capacity, actually. They have to export and then import oil, so that's one of the reasons why they want nuclear capacity. But I think that the danger is that we're fighting over oil and over resources, and that's a lot of what's underlying all of this. Whether global warming's happening or not, there is still a battle about the world's resources and who's going to get benefit from them and who isn't. And of course, the Iranians nationalised their oil industry in the late 1950s, and their democratic government was overthrown by the British and the Americans, and the Shah was put in to keep the Iranians down, to make sure that the oil came out at a price that was suitable for them. And of course, the Iranians know all this history, but many people listening to this from Britain probably don't know that we've got a history of overthrowing the democratic governments of Iran. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that causes wars.
Matthew, are you someone who looks very carefully at the amount of emissions that you put into the environment, and, you know, through your home and through your use of transport and that sort of thing?
Well, my emissions usually go up after a curry, but car-wise, I try to pick a vehicle that has a better than average output, you know, sort of...
Fuel efficiency,
yeah. I mean... There's only so much I can do because I'm using electric in my house and I don't have gas. We don't have it where we are. I don't have any central heating. So my impact's actually quite small. I heat one room in my house and the rest are kept cold. I mean, I think that because so much of this has been exaggerated, I don't take it too seriously. I'm one of the climate deniers, you could say. But I think I'm denying it with good reason because the science really isn't agreeing that there is something there. I mean,
but do you think something should be? Do you think that there's a case for something to be done, or not? Or do you just think that what they're doing is maybe a bit too extreme, or what they're considering at Copenhagen?
Maybe it's part of a strategy to get people to become more environmentally aware. And really, unless you do something scary, people are never going to listen. They'll just carry on in the way.
Right.
So maybe it's about that. Because I remember a management principle when I worked in civil services. If you want to sort of get people to change, and you basically threaten something really bad, and then you actually give them something less than bad, and then they accept the less bad thing, and they think, oh, we've done really well here, haven't we? You know, and I think it's like that with the climate. It's not real, yes, but they're shaking the tree to get people to listen, and then they'll actually give them something that's maybe where they wanted to go in the first place. It's about scare tactics.
And do you think, Martin, there's a real chance of some kind of global tax system of carbon trading emissions?
I don't want to see carbon trading, because that will just create a whole... Because the idea of carbon trading is that the amount of carbon credits will be gradually reduced. This means that the price will necessarily rise, and all of these kind of Goldman Sachs traders and all the rest of it are licking their lips with the idea of being able to trade these permits. And we don't need any more of that. We've got far too much of that already. So the last thing we need is another bubble in carbon trading permits.
And, of course, if these taxes are whacked onto various kind of fossil fuels, etc., then that it's not actually going to be any disadvantage to the big oil companies, etc., because they will just pass that increase in price onto the consumer.
Well, that's right.
They?
I mean, perhaps, and what we'll have to move towards, I mean, what's going to happen in places like Venezuela, they've already done it, is that the oil industry will be owned by governments and not by private industry anyway. And that's been a battle going on since the 50s, since the 40s, yeah? Who is going to control oil? What's the price going to be? And who's going to get the benefit from it? And we've got to move to a situation where the countries which have the oil do get the benefit from it, and we pay a fair price. And also, we've all got to learn to just lower our footprint in a general way, not just in terms of carbon, but in terms of everything that we're using up. You know, we've got to try and share the world's resources in a way that gives everybody a fair go.
There's a conspiracy theory going around the internet. And,
is there really? Yeah, not just, another one.
No, it's only one conspiracy on the internet. I haven't seen any others, have you? But it says that... there's a set of things called the Georgia Guidestones, and on them it's a population reduction message which has been given by the New World Order elite, which say that we must reduce people on the planet by XYZ.
Now, just the Georgia Guidestones are obviously it's in the state of Georgia in the US, and it's a kind of mimicry in a weird way of the Ten Commandments, isn't it? It's sort of ten
different languages as well.
All in different languages. Ten alternative Ten Commandments.
But they're based on sort of reduction of population. It's not about sort of what you should or shouldn't do. It's about, you know, we've got to get rid of people on the planet. And what people have been saying for many years is that the UN has a secret agenda to because the Cold War's gone, they're now looking at the environment as being the new battleground to sort of change people's opinions. So they have to have an enemy out there, and the enemy is you. The enemy is your own damage to the environment and how the planet is going to fail unless you change.
Because, of course, I'm breathing out CO2 right now.
You have to continue, though, Tony.
Okay, anyway.
Not next necessarily.
Thanks, Martin. Hey, cheers. Anyway,
substitute it for helium in a minute.
Anyway, right, next story, India. This one was supplied to me by Martin over the internet during the week, and it's quite an interesting one too. It's in the Christian Science Monitor. Was Mumbai suspect a double agent for the United States? Now, we all remember the Mumbai attacks several months ago with a hotel which was taken over by terrorists. The Indian press, though, is abuzz with news that the Indian Home Ministry officials have said that they are investigating whether a Pakistani-American terror suspect, David Coleman Headley, doesn't sound really like a sort of Pakistani guy, does he? David Coleman Headley was actually working as a double agent for the US. Martin, why did you bring this to my attention? It does look like an interesting thing, and it does seem that the Indian authorities are taking this accusation seriously.
Yes, and it's also from the Christian Science Monitor, which is a very respectable mainstream US quality newspaper. So, you know, this is not just random chatter from the internet. I'm interested because we're still not quite sure what happened in Mumbai. It was just over a year ago. But, of course, many people in Pakistan did not accept that they were directly responsible, although, of course, the Indians and the Americans claim that they were. I think what this brings out is that when terrorist attacks happen in Mumbai or elsewhere, one shouldn't just accept the first story that one is handed. One shouldn't accept the second story either. One should basically keep an open mind, because unless you have inside knowledge, you'll be unlikely to know exactly what's going on, but you need to keep an eye on it. When these attacks happen, it's often a very useful thing to switch your video recorder on or whatever, because lots of things come out which subsequently are anomalous. And it's very important for people to be alert and to be aware of the dangers of what we call false flag terrorist attack. We've discussed it many times on this programme. I mean, one of the things that did definitely come out of Mumbai is that a top Indian police official, whose name escapes me now, begins with K, he was killed in the attack. And he had, the previous 2 weeks, arrested a lot of Hindu extremists for carrying out a bomb attack in a city near Mumbai and pretending to be Muslims. Yeah? So this is actually a standard kind of game that intelligence services and terrorists play, where you plant a bomb or you kill somebody and say somebody else did it in order to put the blame on them.
So you're saying
we've got to be very, very careful about jumping to judgment. Yeah, I'm not saying I know what happened in Mumbai. I don't. But then most people don't.
So what you're saying is possible that the attack was carried out by Hindu terrorists, whereas all the time at the time we were told it was Muslim terrorists from Pakistan.
Some years ago now, they had a Hindu nationalist government in Gujarat state. There was supposedly an attack on Hindu pilgrims on a train, and it transpired that wasn't in fact carried out by Muslims. That was from inside the train, and then that led to a pogrom against the Muslims in Gujarat, in which several thousand people died. And the Indian police investigating that pointed the finger at the state government itself. Yeah? Now, in India...
But what's the motivation behind something... Just a minute. What's the motivation behind something like that?
Because you've got all sorts of... there isn't just one New World Order. Matt mentioned the New World Order earlier. I don't see it as one New World Order. I see what you've got out there is various gangs of gangsters, some of them religious fundamentalists, some of them CIA, intelligence agencies, what have you, some of them just gangsters, like Ibrahim Dawood, who is the biggest gangster in Mumbai, who was implicated in the Mumbai attack by the Indian government, and they all play the same game, which is to try it's controlling perception. You know what we were talking about crop circles earlier, it's controlling perception you make people think that a certain thing has happened, and then they get very fixed in their ideas that this is what's going on, and then they can be bamboozled down the line, whether it's climate change or whatever. Everybody's got to be aware that people are trying to bamboozle you through the propaganda of the deed, if you like. Yeah, they do something in order to plant a seed of something in your mind to make you do what they want, and this is modern psychological warfare techniques. It's all in the psychological warfare manuals of the CIA, the Russian Secret Service, the Israeli Secret Service, whatever.
Are you seriously saying the Mumbai attacks were some kind of psychological warfare operation?
Well, they're obviously a psychological warfare operation. They're either a psychological warfare operation by the Pakistanis or by the Indians or by somebody else. It's an attempt to create an effect, isn't it, by whoever has done it.
Yeah? Anyway, Matt, what are your thoughts on this story, the Mumbai suspect possibly being a double agent for the US?
Well, I mean, I'm very much out of the news because I haven't had a TV and I don't listen to the radio for about 10, 12 years now. But, I mean, as you presented me with this, I would say that my immediate reaction to all news is, you know, what's going on behind the scenes. As little as I can say about it really is, you know, what's
I think
going
it
on
was particularly difficult with these Mumbai attacks because I think they were right in saying there was actually only one person survived it. You know, often it's very, very difficult to figure out what someone's motivation is going to be if everybody's lying on the floor dead, isn't it?
I mean, I got fed up of the television lying to people back in the Iraq war days. You know, that's why I got rid of my television. I know that there's propaganda is terrible on TV. You can't get the real information. It takes a long time and then it's usually ridiculed. What I would say is, yeah, people need to be very careful and look for the false flag, really, in this. And it could be from any side. It could be any side at all. It's all about divide to rule. It's all about problem, reaction, solution, as Mr. David Icke puts it, and various others.
Can you explain that little concept, problem, reaction, solution?
Well, you know, you've got to create a problem so that you can get people to react in a certain way, and then you come along and provide the solution. So, of course, if you plant a bomb, everyone goes, this is terrible, what can we do? And they get very upset, and then you provide the solution, which is usually more control. And that's what it's always been about. So, you know, you plant bombs, and you do kill people, and then you provide solutions, which is usually more money, which comes out of public coffers. And,
so are you suggesting
lockdowns,
that possibly the Patriot Act in the United States, an equivalent legislation over here, was prepared by the same people who were involved in 9/11? That's what you seem to be saying there.
I think that bankers all over the world usually fund a lot of these things. If it's not governments, it's usually people with lots of money because they're the ones that usually lend the money to the governments and the military after these acts have happened. You know, look at the World Wars, you know, and you had both sides being financed by the World Bank. And I mean, you know, which side are they actually on? If they're giving money to both sides, then they don't have a side. So, of course, any trouble that erupts anywhere in the world, you have to look at who benefits. Who actually benefits the most? It's the people who make the money from it. So I always look back to the big money lenders.
Well, it's 5:30 now. Many of you will have heard about the Homelessness Charity Shelters campaign to get Rage Against the Machine in to be the Christmas number one. Well, we have another idea here at BCFM where we've been plugging Vernon's song, which you can get for 50p or so from iTunes and other music download websites. If you have broadband, that is. Alternatively, you can press play and record now.
So sweet the sound of Christmas, so sweet the melody, so rich the celebration of all we have, of all we need, and all around us here, and all around us see, the merry men, the cheer, the warmth that comes from family.
Life's hard sometimes, I have to say, it comes at you in funny ways. Some folk are kind, some folk are bad. Sometimes you're happy, sometimes sad. I never chose to live this way, scraping by from day to day. There is no warning, no alarm, that circumstance will blow apart the very life you came to love. Your friends, your family, growing up, family Christmases and that. You can't put a price on stuff like that. So now I struggle every day to make ends meet and pay my way. Playing my guitar, chords and hooks, to comments, gestures, dirty looks, life's hard.
So sweet the sound of Christmas, so sweet the melody, so rich the celebration of all we have, of all we need, and all around our here, and all the merry men, the cheer, the
hard sometimes, I have to say. Same tired old routine every day. Finding motivation's hard enough when you're cold and damp from sleeping rough. Benches, subways, high street doors, alleyways and car park floors. There's nothing a homeless man won't try to merely keep himself warm and dry. Some people drink, some people use, 'cause they've got nothing left to lose. But I've got a daughter and a son, you see, and they mean everything to me. They give me strength to carry on with this tired old life, this bittersweet song. When things get bad and life is far, I think of them and it makes me smile.
So hey! Sweet the sound of Christmas, so sweet the melody, so rich the celebration of all we have, of all we need, and all around us here, and all around us see. The merry men, the cheer, the warmth that comes from family.
So there you have it. Simple as. Life's tough sometimes, but just because you're feeling low, it doesn't mean you cannot love and you cannot lean on someone who you know and trust, who'll help you when you need it most. A friend, a dog, anyone will do. Someone who understands what you're going through. There's a person sleeping in that bag who needs some help, who needs to have. 'Cause homeless people didn't choose to wear old clothes and tatty shoes. There's more to us than meets the eye, so stop for a chat when you're passing by. Christmas is coming and the goose is getting fat, so please put a penny in Vernon's hat.
So
thank you.
So sweet the sound of Christmas, so sweet the melody, so rich the celebration.
Thank you.
Of all we have, of all we need, and all around us here.
Merry Christmas.
And all around us here.
So that was Vernon there with Vernon's song, proceeds from the sale of which goes to a Birmingham charity for the homeless. And that's definitely number one here on BCFM, hopefully over the new year and Christmas too. So now we go over to Marina Morris, who has a report this week on the Russian oligarchs and their tempestuous relationships and divorces.
It is a crucial question. Why the richest family in the world unhappy and suffering? Can only the quantity of money bring quality in your life's journey? If you explore the different aspect of your deeper self, what needs will you find? Let's listen to what Irina Abramovich, the former wife of the rich Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich, told Russian OK magazine after her 2 years silent about their failed marriage. Irina Abramovich, 41, the former wife of a close friend of Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin and Chelsea owner Roman Abramovich, had been surrounded by bodyguards and lived in constant fear of their children being kidnapped. She said, "My life with Roman was not the fairy tale that the papers reported. Each year it got harder for me. Every week we have to change the numbers of the phones so that nobody knew our location." Mr. Abramovich met Irina on a flight to Germany in 1990, when she worked as an aircraft stewardess. Irina Malandina and Roman Abramovich married in October 1991. They have 2 sons and 3 daughters. The divorce was in February 2007 after a relation between Mr. Abramovich and his former model Daria Zhukova. The divorce was granted in Chukotka, the remote and frozen region in Russia's Far East, where the billionaire businessman was the governor until he resigned in 2008. After their divorce, Irina was awarded £150 million of Abramovich, then $10.8 billion dollars, sorry, pounds fortune. He has also agreed to pay for the couple's five children. Abramovich is one of the Russia's richest men. He had 15th place in Forbes rating in 2008. The 15 richest men in the world slipped into 51st place in 2009. His wealth has significantly declined due to loss in Russia still during the recession. Abramovich bought Chelsea in 2003 for £180 million, but in total has invested something closer to £1 billion in the football club to date. He likes to lead a beautiful life and has bought many elite properties. In 2004, he paid £27 million for the Villa Chateau de la Croix on the French coast. Also, he has a few elite houses in London, three yachts and two Boeing planes. Recently, in May 2008, he bought for the new girlfriend two pictures, one Frances Bacon for £86.3 million and Lucien Freud for £33.6 million. Another Russian oligarch, Boris Berezovsky, the implacable enemy of Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, also has divorce trouble in London. Boris Berezovsky is set to face a divorce battle that could cost him up to $100 million, according to independent reports. Galina Berezovskaya has been married to Mr. Berezovsky for 18 years, although she has been separated from him to almost as long. But they never divorced. She has reportedly instructed a London law firm to enforce her case. She lives in London with the couple's two teenager children. The couple met in 1981, when he was a poor mathematician earning £60 a month. Mr. Berezovsky has lived for the past 16 years with his third long-term partner, Yelena Gorbunova, 42, who calls herself his wife. His associates have said that he will marry her if he divorced Galina. He has six children, two by each partner. There are rumors of associations with other women. He became one of the original Russian oligarchs under President Boris Yeltsin, lending money to the state in return for the valuable stakes in AvtoVAZ, the state airlines Aeroflot, and several oil companies, which he helped organize into Sibneft. Former associates include Roman Abramovich. At one point, he was thought to be worth £1 billion. Mr. Berezovsky is involved in numerous lawsuits in numerous countries, including Russia, Georgia, Belarus, England, and the United States. He recently had to sell his yacht to raise cash. He was granted politician asylum in 2003, when Russia tried to have him extradite on fraud charges. He has since accused Mr. Putin of being behind a plot to assassinate him. Top scandal. Tiger Woods' marriage might be in deep trouble. There are as yet unconfirmed rumors that Tiger Woods' wife wants a divorce and that his mental health is suffering. His public image has slipped and he is the butt of numerous jokes. His sponsors are distancing themselves from his images. Procter & Gamble and Gillette have said they would limit the use of wood in its marketing. The consulting company Accenture, which has used wood since 2003, removed his images from its website. Significantly, AT&T, which has its name on the golf's back, has said it was re-evaluating its relation with the world number one. Different names, but the same problems. Then your selfish ego rules. There can be a price to pay family love. The rich and famous and their families can be suffering. This unstable, insecure life and the lack of positive values, like building houses in the sand. Are they number one in the world or failure? Then family values and standards will their children inherit along this money, and who will be responsible for their troubles life journey?
Thanks, Marina. Now, Matthew, let's just get you on this first of all. Why is it, do you think, that we've got, Marina's just pointed out three particular examples there, that these people who are so wealthy, it seems they've got everything, they just cannot hold down the basic sort of relationship in their lives?
Well, I must say, nice voice, by the way. I love that accent. I really don't know. I mean, rich people, they do all sorts of things. I mean, I'm not the best person to ask this question to. I'm sorry.
Okay, Martin?
What's the question again?
The question is, why is it that these two people we've heard about, Berezovsky, Abramovich, and now Tiger Woods too, seem to, you know, they're larger than life, but they don't seem to be able to sort of hold down their relationship.
Well, what this reminds me of, Marina probably knows this, but there was a very famous soap opera that was very popular in the former Soviet Union called The Rich Also Cry, which came from Mexico. It was a Mexican soap opera, and it was very popular in Mexico and very popular all over Latin America, but it was also the most popular soap opera in Russia. And The Rich Also Cry, of course, is for poor people to sit there and watch, and yes, the rich do also cry. They have divorces, they have a bad time as well. And, you know, our society is very divided, and so, you know, but people actually do, actually lots of people lose their marriages who aren't wealthy multimillionaires. But there's also a fascination, isn't there, with these people, because they are, you know, larger than life. It's the Dallas syndrome, if you like. And it's funny, actually, if we're talking about soap operas, because, of course, British soap operas are always down market. They're about the criminal classes and the sort of failures and the ne'er-do-wells, you know, whereas most soap operas in the rest of the world are about the super rich. But I think that's just something about British culture, I think.
Why is it? The other thing, of course, the question that this raises is why is it that people like Berezovsky and Abramovich have settled down in London? Is it? Do you think that they have
Berezovsky's here because he's fallen out with Putin, as Marina pointed out, and they're bitter enemies. I mean, one of the things Berezovsky accuses Putin of course, is bombing Moscow in 1999. He says that was the intelligence services, and that was backed up by Alexander Litvinenko, who was Berezovsky's protege, who was an ex-FSB officer. But it's not really well reported in the Western media that Berezovsky's main allegation against Putin is that he's a false flag terrorist. And I think the reason for that is that they don't really want to actually remind people that that is the way the world works, whether it's in Moscow or anywhere else. And Abramovich is much more Putin-friendly. He's been very, very close to Putin, and he's been allowed to carry on living in Russia if he wanted to, although he's got an international, you know, circuit now. Khodorkovsky, who's another oligarch, he's not just divorced, he's in prison in Siberia because he really did cross Putin and decided that he was going to do deals with the Israelis about oil, which Putin wasn't happy with, so he had him accused of fraud and banged up in Siberia. All of these oligarchs, of course, came to their money fraudulently, but Putin's an ex-KGB man and he's got all the goods on them, so if they cross him, he just decides, oh, we'll pull down, let's have a look at your file. Ooh, look at all this fraudulent stuff you've been doing, I think you're going to prison, Mr. Khodorkovsky.
So we heard there from Marina that Berezovsky was one of the people that was involved in the privatisation of Aeroflot.
Yeah.
So did many of these oligarchs come into their money through in the Yeltsin years through privatisation deals?
Another thing that's happened this week is Yegor Gaidar has died, who was the finance minister responsible for the breakneck liberalisation of the Russian economy in 91, which meant that most Russians lost their savings. He was actually a communist insider, but he'd been brought in to kind of smash up, you know, to do the Thatcher job on the Russian economy. And of course, during that period, you know, basically state assets were given away to insiders, and they became very, very wealthy on that basis. If you were going to seriously privatise in Russia, it would probably have taken you 30 to 40 years. It had been a very slow process, and that wasn't good enough for the West or for the hungry oligarchs in Russia. They wanted it all, and they wanted it now. But, of course, they actually did a great deal of damage to the economy in the process, and now they're sitting on all these millions. Putin has double-crossed them all because he just let them do all of this, and then, of course, they're holding all of the documents about all of the fraudulent nature of everything that's gone on, and as long as you do as you're told and play ball, as Abramovich has, then Mr. Putin won't have a look in your file. But if you do, then he will.
Well, couldn't there be a simpler explanation for these relationship breakdowns, that actually these women are just simply gold diggers? That they've got into relationships with these fellas in order to get their money.
Western oligarchs have a similar, you know. Donald Trump's got a list of failed marriages, hasn't he? I mean, it's a fairly common thing. you know, you get the trophy wife at a certain stage of your career, and then the trophy wife walks away with half your money. Although I noticed that what Marina was saying, that Abramovich's wife has only got 120 million, which is a lot less than he paid for Chelsea, which is 180 million, and a lot less than he's worth, which is a billion. So she's not actually got a big chunk out of him there, has she?
The only thing I will say is just ban all rich people, and then there won't be any problems. Which isn't actually such a ridiculous thing to say, because I think there should be a cap on the maximum amount of money that people do earn. I think Sweden does this. Yeah. So, you know, they say, well, beyond, say, £1 million a year, you just don't need it. And I think it's even less than that. It's like a couple of hundred thousand a year. You just don't need that money. Plough that money back into creating more jobs and better jobs.
But doesn't that destroy incentives? Because, you know, surely the whole incentive here in the capitalist system is to make more money. And that's what drives people on to do even more innovative things.
Well, it depends. I mean, whether you want to live in a Star Trek type world, which I would, which is that you're doing things for good reasons, not just for the money.
Oh, is that what they do on Star Trek?
Yes.
I think you've got this question of incentives is important as well. Beyond a certain point, there isn't really an incentive. It's just a power trip that they're going for. They don't really need the money, as Matt's pointed out. And in actual fact, you can get them to do what you want them to do and pay them a lot less. I mean, that's what we do in industry when we're talking about people on the shop floor. We try and get them to do the maximum amount for the minimum amount of money. And we should do the same with the wealthy people. Let's have wealthy people, but let's put them in harness and make sure they do the maximum amount of work for the minimum that we can get away with paying them.
I know. Maybe Abramovich can do without his dozen or so villas, his three yachts, his two Boeing corporate jets.
I think he probably could.
Okay. Next story. This is another local one, and this is the Bristol to Gaza aid convoy has been given a rapturous reception in Turkey. An aid convoy including Bristolians committed to providing relief for long-suffering families in Gaza has reached the halfway point of its journey to the Palestinian territory. This is a story covered by Bristol247.com. And as far as I know, not on the BBC, not by the local BBC, and not by the Bristol Evening Post either. Six vehicles from Bristol and a team of nine people are travelling as part of the Viva Palestina convoy, which has now reached Turkey to a rapturous reception from hundreds of local people. And apparently it was also on national television in Turkey. And I'm very proud to say, and on Bristol247.com, you can see a picture of the Bristol lorry. It's the largest vehicle in the entire convoy of about 90 vehicles, which stretches for what looks like around a mile down the motorway through Turkey. So, Martin, do you want to start on this? Because you actually went down to about 3 weeks ago to see the convoy off, didn't you?
It was last week, actually. It wasn't 3 weeks ago, was it?
2 weeks ago, then.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago, that's right, yeah.
Well, I mean, I'll split the difference, yeah.
Okay. It was 2 weeks ago, wasn't it? Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm glad that they're on their way. I mean, they're going to have some difficulties in getting in, possibly, when they get to Gaza, because the Israelis are besieging the place and won't let people in. But if there's enough of them and there's enough pressure, I mean, that's what happened when they went previously. They had to hang around for a long while, but eventually the Israelis relented and let them in. It's a year since the attack on Gaza of January 2009. And apparently the situation inside Gaza is as bad as ever. They've not been able to rebuild properly. Lots of the damage has not been repaired. And they're short of all sorts of basic supplies. And most of the stuff in the Bristol lorry is actually medical supplies. So that's what they're taking.
So, what are your thoughts on this convoy, Matthew?
Well, I think it's very good that the convoy's done what it's done. I think the point is that Bristol media hasn't covered it is the sad fact. There's a lot of people like Nick Park apparently were helping put they're backing to this, and MP Tony Benn, and then for Bristol media sources and newspapers to not cover it, that's rather sad, isn't it?
To be fair, they did cover the send off, but they've not really been following it on the way to Gaza.
I see. Right. Well, I mean, you know, they should be, really, because if Bristol people are putting effort into it, Bristol media should be covering it all the way. And this is the problem. I think that stories that are actually quite positive sometimes don't get covered in the news as much as negative stories. You know, that's my take. So.
Okay, next story. MP Liam Fox, he's a Conservative, a local, or just outside Bristol, Conservative MP, has put the boot in, this is in the Evening Post, into the Bristol City's new stadium bid. Dr Fox told the Evening Post, "I'm opposed to the stadium on the Greenbelt because of the wider picture. I think it's fair to say that for me and lots of my constituents, that's because we're fighting over housing targets in the Greenbelt. This has become an added complication. I think there are many people who would be much less concerned about the siting of the stadium Stadium if they knew it would not lead to the loss of Greenbelt to more housing. Martin, what are your thoughts on what Liam Fox is saying here? Because he's really waded in big time here he doesn't approve of this.
It's quite interesting
because
we had Mark Weston, the Conservative councillor, on here a few weeks ago, did we not? And he was actually arguing in favour of the scheme, and he was saying that in fact the housing development was not allowed by the planning committee. But we then had our own Billy Quayne on talking later about how, in actual fact, this was quite possibly a maldevelopment anyway, and that Bristol City were probably better off in their current home, where people can walk to the game and walk home rather than building a huge new stadium
Martin,
a huge car park.
The club is saying that its current ground at Ashton Gate is too small and outdated and doesn't meet the aspirations to play in the Premiership. So, I mean, surely they need...
What various people have been saying is your aspiration to play in the Premiership is an aspiration, and that in actual fact it's likely to be a white elephant because you're never going to make it. Now, there may be some City fans listening here, so I'm going to be very, very cautious. I don't really know enough about this to have a very strong opinion. I can see that people, you know, it's a big development.
I can see you're backing off now, yeah.
Well, I didn't know what to say about it when Mark was on, but I think Billy's analysis that in actual fact the club is over-egging this, and don't forget that £8 million from Bristol City Council has to go into this development. We're talking about private sector developments and planning permission. Ultimately, the government or the local government has to grease the wheels here. So we're talking about public resources. And, you know, you could argue that that's not really the best use of public resources. But, I mean, in any case, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a good idea to develop out-of-town grounds where people have got to go by car and all the rest of it. I mean, Bristol City is what it is in its ground in where it is now, and it's actually a little family football club. And maybe that's what it should stay. I mean, I'm not really... I've got a strong opinion on this, but maybe that's the best option rather than this grandiose... approach which may come to nothing. I mean, it might not even be properly used. You know, you might have two games a year where the stadium's full and the rest of the time it's just empty.
But so you don't want to think positive about City, and you don't want to think positive about the ground, that we may actually get World Cup games happening in Bristol.
If I was sitting on that planning committee, which I'm not, I would be listening very carefully to all of the arguments, and I think I want to take a pass on whether this is a good or a bad idea, because I think you really need to look at the detail. I mean, Liam Fox is coming from the point of view that his constituents who are living in the Green Belt don't want a development where a load of oiks are going to turn up and spoil it. It's not in my backyard from their point of view, isn't it?
Okay, apparently the decision was a recommendation which will now be discussed by the council's main planning committee on January the 20th, so all eyes will be on that, clearly. The club itself has indicated that it will launch an appeal if the decision goes against them. So it would seem that even if this stadium is turned down on the 20th of January, that's not the end of the matter, is it? Anyway, Matthew, are you a City fan? Are you a football fan yourself?
Sorry, what is football?
Football?
Wales.
Can you explain it to me?
Ah.
No, I don't know what rugby is either. I'm really not.
It's not really a sporty fella.
No, I don't like sports. And to be perfectly honest, you have to turn off now if I'm going to offend you, but I think these competitive games where people try to hurt each other and get one
Well, they don't in football, do they? They're just trying to score goals, for goodness sake.
Whatever the ref doesn't see is good in this game, isn't it? You know, so I'm not into the ethics behind it, really, but they're saying that, I'm not actually against the idea of them building a sort of sports ground outside the city centre if they want to, because, I mean, you can't have everything in a city centre, but put it somewhere where it's not going to cause too much environmental damage, and probably you'll find that will be better, because if people are sort of, you know, taking their cars into the outskirts of Bristol, it's not going to jam up the city centre and cause pollution.
But surely, you know, get these competitive games. I mean, you can't take that seriously as some sort of problem, because it's just a bit of harmless fun, isn't it? All you're doing, I mean, surely you were brought up playing football on the local school playing field and
No, I was
all that sort
made
of thing.
To play these games. They horrified me, I detested it, and I I complained bitterly, and I would be made to stand on the sidelines or go and do something else, and I would bunk off.
You're not a team player?
No, not really sports-wise, in humanitarian sense maybe, but not sports. I just don't like sports. I mean, I'm one of those, you know, stick-in-the-muds, and I'm not doing it. In no way.
Okay, so can we just have a final word from you, Martin? Do you think this is going to go ahead, what with the appeal in January
I think the last point you made about the appeal to the government, the way planning law works, and I did have something to do with some planning applications when I worked for the council, is that unless there's a very, very good reason for not doing something, the commercial developers usually get their way. It's often the planning officers in the council, even if they were opposed to it, it doesn't sound as if they are, will often give in because they know that ultimately the developer will get what they want if they've got the wherewithal to back it up. So I suspect it will go ahead.
Well, it's nearly time now for the Sky News at 6. Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, it will be Christmas Day. And David Bellamy will be taking to the Bristol airwaves the week after. That's New Year's Day. Stay with us if you can, though, because credit crunch beater Billy Quain will be here after the 6 o'clock news with his guide to what's on for free and reasonably cheap around town this weekend. Also, in the next hour, we delve deeper into some of Matthew's crop circle activities, as well as finding out about some of the secret underground military bases in between Bath and Chippenham.
It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.